And joining me now in the studio is Summit County Councilman Glenn Wright. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, Renee.
So you were in that meeting. We just heard Rick's report. It does sound like an emotional issue for those landowners on the east side of the county.
It is. I think Rick's report really captured the emotion in that particular discussion. But I would add a couple of things. We will be discussing both Chapter 3 and Chapter 4 at the March 1st meeting. And nothing's been decided yet. In terms of making mandates on landowners, one of the good things that I think is going to come out in Chapter 4, we're trying to build some tools in there so people can and landowners can get the most out of their land without affecting their neighbors. As Roger was pointing out, you don't want to make the neighborhood ugly, but also there's health, safety, and welfare issues. If you were to have a house every 75 feet, as some proposals suggested, theoretically, you could have if you do the math, you can have 140 new houses on both sides of the street on some of those county roads. What does that do to traffic, safety of traffic? And the major issue is water and sewer. I talked to a resident of the east side during the campaign, and his take on it was having water wells and sewer and septic tanks that close to each other.
That doesn't sound good.
It doesn't sound good, but his take was, well, at least they're drinking their own.
Oh, goodness.
But we can't permit that. But I think a close look at Chapter 4 will show that people will have some options, and we're trying to build some tools in there to maximize the value of the land.
So what Mayor Johnson's comment was about the language, you are allowed to or may be able to. Any comments on that?
I think certainly there's a communication issue between the council and the east side. But you also have to consider what the state law says and what the state law may say in the future. And there's currently a bill in the legislature that will say that anything that isn't prohibited is allowed. So we have to make, if that law passes, we have to make the prohibitions.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense. Moving on to item 3, which sounds a little bureaucratic from the agenda. Last fall, voters approved the 0.25% sales tax, which would be used for capital road improvement projects. So how do we move forward so that cities on the east side can apply for funding for those projects?
That's the whole point of agenda number 3. Derek Radke has come up with a scoring technique, and that we're going to have to work on a little bit. But essentially, the transportation tax, the 0.25% transportation tax, can be applied to some road projects within the eastern county towns. We're estimating the first year with half a year's revenue about, I think, $125,000 and about $250,000 going forward. But again, that depends upon what the sales tax revenues are. The towns will be able to put in a proposal for how to use those funds, and then the COG will rank those projects and fund the projects as money becomes available. A suggestion out of the COG last night was that we had to put some more definite scoring criteria. There were scoring categories, but to put numbers on them was a little subjective. So it was suggested to Derek that he put some numbers, suggested numbers for various characteristics within these scoring categories, and that a Mayor Marchant from Camas would review the project. He's on the CDGB committee, and they already have procedures like that to fund CDBG projects. We're hoping to have a finished product back for the COG at the next meeting in 3 months.
Any idea what kind of east side transportation projects may be in the hopper?
No, we do not at this time. It'll be strictly city proposals, town proposals over there. Could be road widening, could be interchange improvements. It's a road project, though. Those are road projects.
And would cities have to provide a match?
to be determined. And that could be part of that, may be part of the scoring criteria, or it may not be. That was another part of the discussion last night. Does there have to be a match?
It's my impression that when that tax was put on the ballot and people approved it and they were thinking of capital improvements and transportation projects, that they were mostly thinking of the Park City area in 224 mm-hmm. and 248. I didn't hear a whole lot about East County transportation needs.
I'm sure that was the perception on this side of the county, but the tax passed countywide, and the presentations were made to all the town councils over on that side of the county that this was the vehicle for getting some money for additional money for city and town road improvements. So that was it was known amongst the city councils on the east side.
Got it. And if they do get some changes in development and there is more building out there, they will need, as you pointed out at the beginning of this discussion, some infrastructure improvement.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's move on to flood preparation. We're looking outside. We're getting more snow. It's been a wet year. What are you hearing about that in the county?
Well, the weather, as our forecaster said, the weather is unpredictable. We're certainly going to get melting. There's some known parts of the county that have had flooding problems in the past. This presentation was fairly brief, again, from Derek Radke. All he did was let the mayors know that the county has sand and sandbags that can be delivered to them upon request when flooding occurs. And, of course, we'll be using those for the unincorporated areas.
And you also talked about the Oakley River Project. Summit County Council had voted to give $500,000 to Oakley to help buy, I think it's 23 acres along the riverfront there. You voted for this grant. Tell us why.
Sure. I think the presentation last night was from Dave Thomas, and there was a video from Oakley about this project. And it will potentially conserve a vital stretch of the Weber River that goes through Oakley that is currently available to the public for public use. You can access it, and the funds will be used to either buy land or buy conservation easements so that it will be permanently available for the public. Some of the video that we saw showed other areas along the Weber where you have fences and no trespassing signs. So this is kind of the last stretch of the river that can be enjoyed by all of the public of Oakley and of county residents. And it's a beautiful stretch of river.
Mayor Wade Wolstenholme in Oakley, I'd interviewed him when this grant was approved, and he sounded very positive about it, as did Tom Smart on the Oakley City Council. And they said there would be a public hearing coming up in Oakley at some point in February, they hope. Do you know if that's happened?
I believe I don't have my calendar in front of me. I have my calendar. I believe it's next week. And it's either Monday or Tuesday next week.
We will find out, and we'll report that on KPCW, because I know a lot of people are interested in putting
their input in. I remember seeing the notice that it's at Cattleman's Hall, and I put it on my calendar. Ask me after I get out of here, and I can find the information for you.
Thank you. And the mayor had said it was very important to them to get their citizens' input on what that project looks like.
Yes.
It could be the access to fishing. It could be trails. It could be parks. Possibilities are endless, I guess.
And the important thing, you're not going to buy 23 acres for $500,000. The county's money is seed money. The Open Lands
Summit Lands Conservancy.
Summit Lands Conservancy will be looking at raising some money for that. City of Oakley may have to also. That's all going to be part of their internal discussion.
While we're speaking of open lands, of hot topic, Bonanza Flats, mm-hmm. that Park City is trying to raise $13 million for that purchase. What's the latest from Summit County on their input with that effort?
We have discussed it. I'm not going to step on the news that should come out this week, I expect. The city and county have come to a general agreement, but I'm not going to go any further than that and step on the news that will be forthcoming shortly.
So news is coming.
News is coming.
We will stay tuned for that. We know that council's been having some closed-door meetings on property acquisition. There's a special meeting on Tuesday. Any idea when the outcome of those meetings will be made public?
depends when the negotiations come to fruition.
Okay.
So I don't have a crystal ball on that one. We discussed strategies for various pieces of land for conservation purposes, and we'll see how negotiations proceed.
And I know sometimes it's frustrating for members of the public when they hear about these things and they say, hey, you're using taxpayer money. Why isn't this part of the public record? And that's because real estate acquisition is not subject to open records laws because of that competitive issue. Is that right?
That's exactly right. As an example, what if we were trying to purchase several pieces of land and we felt that one piece of land was more valuable than the other, but the adjacent property owner said, you paid him that much, why don't you pay that me that much?
Mm.
So each negotiation is private.
Okay.
Until the deal is finalized, then we bring it out to the public and...
We will stay tuned.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there's some good things in the works if we can make it happen.
Oh.
I think the public will be pleased. We have a pot of money from a past open space bond, and... I think if all these projects come to fruition, I think the public will be pleased that we made some good decisions with their money.
All right, Glenn. You're putting a lot of good stuff out there. Can't wait to hear the follow-up. So, a big topic. Tonight, there's going to be a meeting at St. Luke's Church at 6 o'clock, and it is a community town hall organized by Sally Elliott, a former Park City Council member, longtime community advocate. Beth Armstrong, the head of the People's Health Clinic, she's going to moderate this discussion. We're going to have Police Chief Wade Carpenter there. We're going to have Summit County Sheriff's Justin Martinez there, members of the ACLU, an attorney with Holy Cross Ministries. The whole point of this meeting, according to Sally, is to separate fact from fiction when it comes to immigration arrests in this area. There were four people arrested on Friday, which had sparked some pretty sweeping rumors. And with the Trump administration and what they did on Tuesday, announcing that they were going to change the criteria for removal enforcement, I think is how they put it. Your take on this, what are you hearing as a county council member?
Well, I'll be there to listen to the public tonight. I'll be in the audience. I'm hearing some of the same things you have. You know, the immigration force has not been very forthcoming in terms of telling us what the details were of the removals. Also hearing strong rumors and reports from people who witnessed actions in the community during that period of time that there were other semi-enforcement actions, questioning people for their identification and fingerprinting. I don't know any of those details specifically. So that's something we need to hear about tonight. I think the key thing with listening to the new Trump regulations on removals and deportations, I think it adds a large element of unpredictability for the population. For the past 8 years, we're primarily concentrating on known criminals. Now when you expand the definition to anybody who's in the country illegally as criminal, and you have you're opening yourself to the very capricious nature of the individual enforcement agent's attitude on that particular day. I think that's a dangerous policy, but at the end of the day, immigration is a federal issue, and we have in Summit County and Park City very minimal effect to it. Ability to affect those policies. I think we can be supportive as we can of our community and make sure everybody knows their rights, and even undocumented residents have rights. Make sure everybody knows their rights and make sure, the most we can do is make sure that they're being followed.
Great. We have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Glenn Wright, Summit County Councilman. We'll see you tonight at the immigration meeting.
See you.
Welcome back to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. The time is 8:32. I'm Renee Bodley, filling in for Leslie Thatcher. We're going to get an update now on that closure on Interstate 80. You cannot get from Park City to Salt Lake City on I-80 this morning. Lisa Miller from UDOT's on the phone with us now. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Renee.
What's the latest?
Well, the westbound lanes are still closed at this time, our current estimate for clearance is as much as 2 hours. The semis involved in the crash did have all of the oil that they were carrying offloaded to another vehicle, and the damaged semi-trailers that were involved have been moved to the chain-up area. However, our crews have not been able to assess the roadway damage at this time. When they clear the debris fully, they'll be able to do that.
And what can you tell us about alternate routes to get to Salt Lake City from Park City this morning?
Well, the alternate routes are unfortunately lengthy. If you're going I-84, it's about 85 miles from the Silver Creek Junction to Salt Lake City. Provo Canyon is just a little bit longer at 93 miles. And Google Maps right now is actually taking into consideration the fact that I-80 is closed in Parley's Canyon, and they're actually rerouting traffic and recommending that I-84 is the shortest route. It's about an hour and 45 minutes. And at Google Maps right now, earlier this morning, there was some delay on that alternate route on I-84 because that's the best route for trucks to take versus U.S. 40 through to U.S. 189 in Provo Canyon. So it's always a great idea to check the UDOT traffic app, maybe check the Waze app before you head out so you know what you're going to encounter on the roads.
Okay, so in summary, when are we looking for a clearance time right now?
Well, we always have an estimated clearance time. It's very hard to tell, but probably around 2 hours at this point is our best estimate. And if your listeners want to get up-to-the-minute information, they can always go on the UDOT Traffic app or website and click on the little incident icon. It's a black exclamation point within a red triangle. Once they click on that, they can get information on the lanes that are impacted, the delay that we're expecting, as well as an estimated clearance time.
Okay, Lisa Miller, we'll stay in touch with you throughout the morning. If anything changes, we'll let our listeners know. We appreciate your time.
Great, thank you.
So for those of you who are just tuning in this morning, westbound lanes on I-80 are closed. You cannot get to Salt Lake City from Park City on Interstate 80. That's because two tanker trucks collided last night about 11 o'clock. They were carrying crude oil. One tanker caught on fire, and the driver of that truck had died. About 1,500 gallons of crude oil burned in that incident, according to Park City Fire Chief Paul Hewitt. About 200 gallons of that oil spilled on the ground. They're still trying to assess the damage on the roadway. That could take, from what it sounds like, what we just heard from Lisa Miller, about 2 hours. And then she is suggesting that you take, if you need to get to Salt Lake City, that you leave Park City, that you head east on 80, that you take Highway 84 through Ogden Canyon, and then take I-15 southbound to Salt Lake City. In studio to give us the details is Commissioner John Phillips. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
So a 70-minute meeting. When's the last time that happened?
Oh, it's been a while. It's been a while. We don't mind when that happens. So it's refreshing. So
let's start with Park Avenue. The properties at 1450 and 1460 Park Avenue. The discussion was continued to a later date. We know the foundations on those properties are poured and ready to go. These are the affordable housing projects. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
What's the holdup?
They're working out some parking issues in the configurations. We didn't speak about it. We just continued it. So we didn't really discuss in length or ask any questions of what was going on. But I know that they requested a continuation so that they could, figure out what it is that, they needed to bring to us so that we could have a good discussion on it. So,
and how many units will be there?
I believe there's 8 units.
Got it. And the historic character of those properties is going to be preserved.
Correct. Yes, that was put in as a condition on that project.
You also discussed 1750 Sidewinder. That's the new location for the Intermountain Park City Instacare. They needed a conditional use permit for their sign, which seemed fine. However, Commissioner Steve Joyce drove by, and he said he's concerned about the close proximity of the sign to the sidewalk. What was the culmination of that discussion?
I think there was agreement among the Planning Commission that it was close to the sidewalk. And I think Adam Strawn had added to that it could possibly be a visible obstruction for, the pedestrian interaction with the vehicles at that intersection. So one of our concerns was that the vehicles that are trying to get onto the main road there, they're looking at traffic and trying to find their opening and maybe not necessarily paying attention to the pedestrians on that pathway, and that sign could potentially obstruct the driver's view of someone that might be coming down that path. So I think in the end, we left it with the discretion of the planners, and I believe we asked that Heinrich also do a site visit when they go to place the sign. I think we just want to make sure that it is that it's off the path, so it's not a physical hazard for people that might be riding a bike and accidentally hit it, and then also just making sure that it does not cause any problems with the interaction of pedestrian and vehicular. So,
and that's a pretty heavily traveled pedestrian area, isn't it?
It is, and it's a difficult intersection for vehicles to navigate as well. So,
and then staff made some recommendations for changes to the land management code, some of which is going to be sent back to council for consideration regarding the storefront enhancement program. Can you explain that to us?
I think, what the planning department and city council have actually spent a lot of time on this and have, and they've had a lot of discussions. And so, by the time it got to us, it had been pretty well thought through, and we had a little bit of input to add and send that to the city council. But basically, the intent is to limit the size of a storefront, and that will help maintain an active streetscape and the flow of Main Street, where we have a lot of businesses, right one after another. And I think it is basically to prevent, very large storefronts that may take up a huge chunk of, one or two buildings. And that will help prevent big stores from coming in and, taking over a good chunk of Main Street. It also, one of the other things that I liked about it was that it would allow stores to have a big store, but they just can't take up the whole street storefront. And in doing that, it would, if somebody did come in and want to have a larger store, which is still possible, they would have to basically carve out part of their storefront for another business, which would potentially help with incubator businesses and smaller businesses. And those are things that I think the city is trying to encourage to kind of keep the feel of Main Street and that small town and, try to retain what we've had and what has made Main Street what it is. So,
and to be a little more transparent about it, chain stores is what we're trying to avoid. Are we trying to avoid a Gap and a Banana Republic and an Old Navy on Main Street?
Yeah, I think mainly, yeah, it's probably directed towards that. But if you look beyond that, it really would apply to any store. Even if it was a local company that wanted to come in and have a large store, it's not necessarily in the best interest of Main Street to have that occur, whether it be a local company or, a large store like Gap, I know is mentioned. I guess it's just used as an example. But I think, it's a step in the right direction to do that. I know that there will be more. From what we were told, the people that are working on this are looking at other things that we could do to just basically preserve what we have, I think, is the intention.
And you're talking about expanding this storefront limitation to Sweet Alley as well.
Yeah, that's what I believe we are kind of adding to the discussion. I know that it had been discussed with the council reading through their minutes, and I think we discussed it, and we just weren't sure why that would not apply on this side to limit the size. I don't know if there's really, as I'm sitting here looking down, I don't know if there's really anywhere where there could possibly be anything larger than 50, but all the more reason, why can't we just put that in there as language? And I know there is a lot of, there's been a lot of thought, and I know they are continuing to consider what we can do on the Sweet Alley side, what we want it to be, and try to get ahead of that so that we can decide what we want to happen before it happens to us. So,
and thank you for mentioning the 50 feet. That's the parameters we're talking about?
Yes, 50 feet is basically the maximum width on a storefront.
Is there anyone on Main Street right now that is over 50 feet?
There are a few. Without going through and pointing out which ones, I know that in the staff report they had mentioned, maybe there's 8.
Oh.
Possibly, but there's 60 businesses or more on Main Street. So there are a few. And I don't know if they're necessarily, this won't affect them. I think they're basically,
they'd be grandfathered in?
Yeah.
Okay. And then Treasure Hill did not present the traffic report this month because they wanted to do a current study over the weekend. And I think they wanted to do it over President's Weekend, which makes sense, a holiday weekend when we're most busy. Have you heard anything about results yet?
No, we haven't, and we won't until our next meeting on Treasure, I believe, would be our second meeting in March. So, there's a little bit of time in between our meetings there. Hopefully they had success in putting together this information, and I think we all look forward to looking at it and seeing what the impacts are learned from it.
Okay. Anything else you want to add from the meeting?
Let's see. We did talk about we did eliminate the pre-application process for MPDs last night, or we changed it, I guess is a better way to put it. It was required for a master plan development to come in with a pre-application. And I think over the years as that has been implemented, I don't think that it achieved its purpose. And I think the original purpose was to kind of get ahead of where a project might be going, and I think one of the intentions was to try to help the developers save money on building, drawing these plans, and going through doing all these studies and then coming to us. The purpose was to kind of give them a lighter approach to that and come with us with less information so that they could get earlier input from the Planning Commission. But I think in the end, it didn't really achieve its goal. And when we would get to the end of the process, one of the things that we are supposed to do is, we're supposed to see that it complies with the general plan. And it was a really tough situation, I think, for all parties involved, because there's not enough information in the pre-application to make a determination, and it just never felt like it was achieving what it was set out to do. So the good thing is that it is still something that is available for an MPD to do by choice, and I would imagine that it will still be used. So we basically, instead of making it a barrier, which it was, is something that had to be done, it was more of another hurdle to jump through. I think it gives them more flexibility to just come in and present what they would like to, and that way they can just have more of an open discussion about what we think about where their project is headed.
And can you tell our listeners NPD stands for?
Master Plan Development. So that they're larger developments, and there's certain criteria that make a project a master plan development. So
gets the conversation going a little earlier, and sounds a little more informally than otherwise.
Yes, and it has been to this point. It's always been less formal, but I think we heard from someone last night that the process actually costed them money just to do this part and then to move on. So, it, you know, instead of saving money, which was, I think, one of the intentions of saving the developers money, in the end it was, and it was costing them some money.
Thank you very much, Planning Commissioner John Phillips. Thanks for being here this morning.
Thank you.
And we're back here at the Local News Hour at KPCW. We've got an update now on library fields. There's been an effort to preserve library fields as open space. Seems to have support from City Council, but there is still one more step to go. Joining me in studio this morning is community activist. Is that the best way to refer to you? Ed Parisian. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Renee. How are you? Yeah, well, like gentleman activist.
Gentleman activist, yeah. It is. So you've been front and center on all of this. Tell us what the latest is with Library Fields.
Well, the latest is we've got a vote coming up in March, March 16th, and the Library Field has been going through the process, and there is a process through the city to get this accomplished, and we've pretty much gone through the process, and now it's gone through COSAC twice now, and they're going to recommend a third-party easement on the field, and it's up to the City Council to vote it.
And COSAC stands for Citizens Open Space Advisory Committee, and there
correct.
Is something, if I understand correctly, that you're not totally 100% on board in, and that is treating library fields as all other city parks are treated.
Well, they thought about it. I mean, that was kind of... And I understand the city said, well, let's look at some options. They agreed to preserve it in September in perpetuity. And they said, let's figure out what the best instrument to do this is. So they sent it back to COSAC, who involved the RAB, Recreation Advisory Board. And they came back with the same conclusion that probably that the library field is unique. And it can't really be bundled with all the other parks, like City Park and some of the other smaller pocket parks, that a library field is a unique circumstance. And they agreed. It's like, it really is. It's tough to make a blanket policy on all parks because they have different needs and they serve different people. But the library field is different. And they decided that it was, and they said, okay, let's just treat this separately and preserve this field because it's got so much local support for it.
What are the purposes that you see for the field? Right now, I think people think of Library Field as beautiful open space for a picnic or throw a frisbee or take your dog there, because it is an off-leash area for dogs as well, isn't it?
It is.
And could those uses change or be added to?
I mean, the best use is no use. Just a field of grass is what we've always said. Just leave it as a field of grass and let people do what they will. And it's big enough that some people play frisbee in the corner, some people take a dog on the other corner, and some people, you know, play a little softball in another corner. It's kind of a great field because it's not programmed. There is no lines on it. There is no ball field. You come, you pick a spot, and you do your thing, picnic, whatever. I've seen people camping out there at night just because they couldn't find a place in town. They throw up a tent, and it's kind of cool. It's kind of a little throwback. It's great.
So what would you like the citizens of Park City to do to help preserve this?
Well, they've done a lot already. Let's put it that way. We've signed the petitions. We had 95% success rate on our petitions. I mean, very few people were opposing this. I'm sure there's a couple out there, but it's very popular. It's very a lot of sway. That made my job easier. I was just a voice for the people. I happen to have extra time, apparently. So... people have done it, they could send an email to the city council and let them know their thoughts on it. I mean, we're pretty well down the process at this point, and I think it's the vote will happen. But every little voice helps because we want this to be a win-win. We want the city to want this, the city to embrace this. The people have already embraced it. I think the ultimate goal was never to be an adversarial thing. We always wanted to be a win-win because everyone knows it's a good thing, I think. And I think city council believes that. And, you know, the win-win outcome was critical. I mean, I've enjoyed this process
and
myself.
There seemed to be a whisper of a rumor out there, and I think it came out of a work session with city council, that someone mentioned, gosh, maybe that's a good space for affordable housing. But it was never really a real threat, was it?
it's always a real threat because that piece of property is flat. It's easy to build on. So as long as it was never protected, it was always a threat. That not by this city council particularly, and it probably wasn't, but 30 years, 40 years, two generations, three generations, you know, we call it the next greatest thing. What is the next best thing in the, you know, there's always someone that wants to build on that because it is city-owned property and it is, you know, it's vulnerable because, and it was vulnerable in 91 when they saved it the first time, you know, and you forget over the generations that this land comes up into play. And that's what happened when they looked at the design studio a year and a half ago.
And so can you give our listeners an idea what you mean by third-party perpetual easement? What kind of third party are we talking about?
Something like Summit Lands or Utah Lands, a third party that specializes in trusts for open space. They have the means, they have the means to defend it against challenges. And that's why you get it out of the city's hands or whoever owns it hands, and you put in a third party because there's a trust document that says you can only do this, 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 this. And they have the means to defend it against any incursions or whatnot.
Thank you, Ed. Anything else you want our listeners to know about Library Fields?
Just that, go there. Enjoy it. It's everybody's field, and let's hope it stays open forever. And I've got a little something planned on the field when we do get this all done, so we'll let you know that in maybe after the meeting in March. It's going to be fun.
And that meeting is March 16th. Not a public hearing, though, right? Just something that City Council has on their agenda for March 16th.
Right. It's on their agenda. It'll be 6 p.m.
Okay.
At the council.
Great.
We'll see you all there.
Ed Prigent, gentleman activist, we appreciate you being here this morning.
Thanks for